Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
We're in Roswell, and of course we have resident Dennis Balthizer. You have been here, what, 10 years?
Yes, 96.
I moved up here. I'm keeping up with you.
You sure are. So are other people.
Well, we've done some shows about that in the past. But you're going back to Stillwater regardless of that.
That's right. That's right.
You look good today. Very, very spiffy.
Well, thank you. It's a good time of the year to celebrate our freedom.
That's right. It's the 4th of July.
We can do this today because we have that freedom, you know.
That's right. I want to talk to you about a place that I want to ask you about the freedom up there. You just came back from Area 51.
I did.
What was your impression?
Well, I've been
I saw some interesting pictures. I'm on the website, by the way.
I've been studying Area 51 as one of the four areas of research I do, along with the Roswell incident, underground bases, and the Great Pyramids of Egypt and Giza. But to go to Area 51, when you say you went to Area 51, you really didn't. You went to the entrance to Area 51 because that's as far as you're going to go.
Yeah, now one of those pictures that looked like a regular gate. And a regular road going in there.
There's two entrances. There's a main entrance which runs off the extraterrestrial highway between Ash Springs and Rachel, Nevada. That was renamed the extraterrestrial highway. Yes. It's 375. That was named that by the governor a couple years ago. And off of that road is a straight line dirt road, well maintained, that runs about 11 miles back to the mountain range. There are no signs to indicate there's anything back that road. And when you go down that road, about 13 miles, you run into some signs that are warning signs, including one sign that says the use of deadly force is authorized. And my wife and I were driving down that road, and I told her at about 10 miles, I said, start watching the hills because you'll probably see a Jeep or a gray pickup come up over one of these hills, and that'll be the guards checking on us. Well, much to my surprise, we came around the corner and we saw the signs, and when we looked up in the hill, there was a gray pickup parked up there, two guys in it with camouflage uniforms on, both of them with binoculars facing our direction. So they knew we were on our way before we knew that they would be there. And what happens is they have sensors in the road, and the guardhouse is located about a quarter mile behind the signs. There's no gates, by the way, at the main entrance, just the signs. But once they are notified by these sensors that there's someone on the road, they have time to get out of the guardhouse, get in the truck, and get up in the hill and wait for you.
And at one time, I think they used Jeep Cherokees, but it's pickups now.
No, they still have them. We found them, too.
Okay.
And what's interesting, they have U.S. government plates on the vehicles, and the first two digits on the license plates are the year of the vehicle. So most of the Jeeps, most of the white Grand Cherokees are 95 models, while the gray Ford and Chevy four-wheel drive pickups are 2000, 2002 models. They're newer models. But at the main gate, they say main gate, there are no gates. It's just these signs. And then if you look up on the hills, you'll see cameras that are solar-powered cameras where they keep tabs on you. They also have listening devices where they can hear every word you're saying while you're there. So having studied this and seen pictures for years, it was kind of ironic to be standing there at the signs and knowing that they're sitting up there looking at me with binoculars.
Well, did they come down and meet you?
No. In fact, they are instructed not to interfere with the public. Well, they don't have to. If you cross the line, you belong to them. And what they normally do is they will turn you over to the local sheriff. The local sheriff will interrogate you. The signs have two warnings on them. One is a fine of $600 and 6 months in prison, and the other one is a $1,000 fine and a year in prison, or both. And those are both federal security regulations of the United States government. I just wrote an editorial, which is on my website, on your website.
Yes, it is.
20 other websites and UFO magazines. And in there, I made a statement that Area 51 has been in existence since 1955. It was opened by the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, to test the U-2 aircraft. In that time, since 1955, to my knowledge, no one has breached the security of Area 51. But we cannot control the United States border. My question is, do we need a sign on the border saying the use of deadly force is authorized?
Have we ever heard of anybody that just didn't pay attention to the signs and went on in?
Yeah, there have been a few that have crossed the line for some dumb reason, and they have been interrogated, they have been fined, and they will know where you're at for the rest of your life.
They weren't close enough for you to tell if they were paramilitary or real military?
They're not. They're WAC and HUD. WAC and HUD is the security at Area 51. They call them camo dudes because they wear camouflage uniforms. There are no insignias. There are no names, no identification on the uniforms at all. And they have been in use for, I guess, as long as the base has been in existence. A few years ago, they tried to go on strike, and they were pretty well threatened that if you go on strike, you'll never have another job anywhere. So to me, it would have to be a boring job to be sitting out there in the middle of the desert unless somebody like I show up. You know, there's really not much to do but sit there and look at what little wildlife there is.
Dennis, it's empty out there, isn't it? I mean, there's not much going on.
There's absolutely nothing. Between Ash Springs and Rachel, there's a lot of nothing, you know.
Yeah, it makes Roswell look scenic.
Yeah.
And Roswell is a nice town. I'm talking about as you come into town. There's mm-hmm. not much here. Especially when you come in from where I live, Oklahoma.
Well, the town of Rachel, which is the only town in Tonopah, between Ash Springs and Tonopah, Nevada, is the little town of Rachel. There's about 85 people in their population. They have a Baptist church. They have a little bar and cafe known as the Alien Inn.
Which did you stop in there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we ate all our meals there for 3 days. And
Is Pat Travers still there?
No. Pat.
They now have some other lady running it.
Pat runs it, yeah. Her and her husband, Travis, ran it for the last several years.
He passed away.
He passed away, and Pat now runs it, and she's just wonderful. She's just a great lady and a joy to be with. And they barbecued every day for all the speakers, and we had big cookouts every day for every meal. The motel consists of house trailers that are two-bedroom with one bath that's shared. My wife appreciated that, having to share a bathroom with three guys. But we made it through that okay. When we checked
in... So in other words, they're kind of double-wise of a bathroom in the middle or
right,
something?
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, that's the motel.
Okay.
And then... when we checked in, my wife went in the room.
Is it expensive?
I don't know. They provided my expenses since I was a speaker.
Okay.
I wouldn't think so. But when we checked in and my wife went in the room, I went back out to the pickup to get something, and I walked around the corner. There's a 4-foot gopher snake laying there. So I went in the Alien Inn, and I said, I need some help out here. And some guy came out, and it had crawled up inside of a pickup in the motor. And he reached in and grabbed me. He said, oh, yeah, he said he comes by here every so often.
Well, yeah, at night it still gets cold in the desert, even though it's hot.
What I did find interesting, Jerry, was not the main gate, but the back gate. And Chuck Clark lives there. Chuck has been on the government's list for several years, doing things that they think he shouldn't do. And he took us out to the back entrance. Now, at the back entrance, they have two double gates. They're swing-down gates that have stop signs on them. There is a guard.
That's the picture I was talking about.
Yeah, there's a guardhouse.
Gates.
There is a guardhouse there. All the windows are blackened where you can't see in. There is a sensing device. There is a camera mounted on about a 30-foot-high tower. And I was walking along the fence along the border, and every time I moved, I'd look up, and the camera was following me. If I moved, the camera moved. If I moved, the camera moved. So they were watching me. And we were there for quite a while, and all of a sudden, from inside the base on the road, we saw dust. And pretty soon we saw a black spot on the road, and we got binoculars and looked, and sure enough, there was one of the white Jeeps. They had brought reinforcements in. He's sitting in the white Jeep with binoculars, looking at us, looking at him with binoculars. And after a little while, he came up to the guardhouse, and he opened both doors, his door and the passenger door, and took some kind of a bag out and tried to stay out of sight where we couldn't get a picture of him, which I did. And went in the guardhouse for a little bit, and when he came out, he was, instead of coming around and closing the passenger door, he got in the Jeep, backed the Jeep up, and hit the brakes trying to close the door. Well, the door didn't close, so he was upset, and he had to lean over and lay down in the seat and reach over and pull the door shut because he didn't want to be on camera anywhere. But it was quite an experience.
Did you make any contact with him, like, hello, how are you?
No. They've been given instructions not to harass people. I think just the fact that they're there is enough to defer anybody from wanting to go any further than the signs.
How difficult is it to get to this back gate?
Not at all. In fact, you can get there from in Rachel. You take a dirt road off towards the mountains and make one turn, and that takes you right up to the gate.
Could you see any facilities at all down?
Yeah, they have. There's some Russian radar that is used for some of the exercises they have. There were some big pieces of radar equipment off in the distance towards the hills that you could see. But that was all. They have exercises there two or three times a year, red flag, green flag, where they actually do dogfights and things like that. They have captured Russian MiG airplanes that we fly, and they do a lot of testing there. The latest problem that Chuck Clark has is they're testing and running the F-22 Raptor.
Tell me about that.
This is a new aircraft that has a capacity of about 1.8 Mach on speed. And Chuck is a big environmentalist, and does a lot of picture taking on native flowers and things like that. He found some petroglyphs in one of the mountains that are very, very rare. And he said by this Raptor running down, his F-22 running down the valley at better than double the speed of sound, it's blowing the petroglyphs off of the face on these mountains. So he said he's tempted to notify the Air Force that they can find some other place to do their playing if they want to, because he don't think that should be damaged. So we'll see what happens with that.
He's been there for a long time, I think.
Yeah, I think he's been there about 8 or 10 years. I've been working with him since 1996. We've done a lot of research together, and he's got some excellent pictures. He gave me a disc with some pictures on it. One of them is a declassified picture showing 10 SR-71 Blackbirds sitting on a tarmac up at Area 51.
Not one, not five, but 10.
I didn't have any idea we had 10 of them.
And I didn't know that either.
One of them obviously is a trainer because it has a cockpit behind the cockpit. So it's made a little bit different than the others, but there's 10 SR-71 sitting there together.
Well,
most of our aircraft, like I said, the base was opened by the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, in 1955. to test the U-2, and all aircraft that have been developed in secrecy since then have been test flown there. Not all aircraft, but all aircraft that were secret, like the A-10, the A-12, the stealth F-117 fighter, the B-1, the B-2. They've all been test flown there from time to time.
While you were there, what, 3 days?
Mm-hmm.
Did you see any aircraft?
Didn't see a thing because it was the Memorial Day weekend, and I think probably the base was fairly well shut down for the holiday, so we didn't see anything. The black mailbox that everybody has heard about that's on the rancher's property right next to the extraterrestrial highway.
Did you go by there?
Got pictures of that. That's now painted white.
No longer black.
And there's actually two mailboxes. One is the rancher who has his name and box number on the mailbox, and the other one is a smaller box on the bottom, and it has a slot that looks like it would accept checks or maybe small letters, and it's got alien written across the bottom of that. So that's for alien mail, I guess.
So they're getting checks from home.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder what the bank was drawn on. But anyway, you'll never know.
Area 51 for me has been a catch-22 situation ever since I've started researching it, because, first of all, we need a place to test new aircraft, new technology, and we don't want to do that where our adversaries know what we're doing. The rumors are that there's 22 levels below ground at Area 51, and as many as 7 at Papoose Lake, adjacent to Area 51.
Yeah, we talked to you about that before. Did you see any evidence?
No. It's all back on the other side of the mountain where you wouldn't be able to visually see it from where we were.
When Groom Lake, that's on the reservation itself, I guess, or overlooking it, I guess, maybe.
Groom Lake is on the other side of the mountain. That's mm-hmm. part of the base. There are two runways there. One is 15,000 feet. The other is 30,000 feet. That's 6 miles of runway. That tells me that they are bringing something in at tremendous velocity, because you don't need a lot of runway for takeoffs. but for landing something, you need a lot of runway. And you could land two space shuttles from opposite directions that don't use brakes when they land, just a parachute. And you could land two from different directions, and they would be a mile apart when they stopped.
We'll be back to talk with Dennis Balthizer a little bit more on his trip to Area 51. And I know he ran across some interesting people there while he was speaking, and we'll talk to him about that. And he has some other projects we want to talk to him about as well. And we're in his hometown now of Roswell, New Mexico. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away.
I'm Jim Mars, author of Alien Agenda, the world's top-selling nonfiction book on UFOs. I'm here today to tell you one of the most fascinating stories I've come across in my career as a journalist. The secret of Reggate is that so many people in one small American community now know that there is so much more to the universe than what we see and experience in our everyday world.
Save $5 this month when you purchase The Secret of Reggate DVD from ShopJerryPippin.com. This film won the prestigious People's Choice Awards at the 2004 UFO Conference. The Secret of Reggate will astound you. You will want to see it again and again. Save $5. Order it now this month only at ShopJerryPippin.com. Secret of Reggate, a Linda Cowan production. Okay, here we are again with Dennis Balthizer. Before he gets off, I'm going to have to talk to him about the pyramids in Egypt, but we're a long ways from there right now. We're in Roswell, New Mexico, and we're talking about Area 51. A member in our audience, Dennis, during the commercial break, wanted to know about deliveries. And I was talking to Larry Dickin about that the other day. I said, you know, they have to truck things in. He says, no, I think they fly everything. And I said, I don't know. They must truck something in, like groceries. Any evidence of a road that can handle trucks?
Employees at Area 51 are brought in one of two ways. The local people, that are, or I say local, within several miles, I guess, of the base, go to the base daily in white buses that have the windows pretty well blacked out. Now, they have their own airport terminal at McLaren Airport in Las Vegas. And there, they are using old America West 737 airplanes that are painted completely white, no markings other than a identification number for the aircraft itself. There's no logo or anything like that. And I've also heard that those windows are painted black or blocked out. And I don't know if that's to keep people from seeing who's inside or if it's from keep people inside being able to see outside.
That's a good point. Could be either.
But Those flights, they're called Genet flights. They arrive and depart from Area 51 several times a day. There's been a lot of rumors over the years that they were either shutting down the base or moving it. We have knowledge where they have just built a brand new water tank to store water, and that may be necessary because probably the water that's there is contaminated by radiation. The other thing is that I think in most cases when you're doing secret work, if you're on a certain project and you finish that project, you can easily be transferred to another base, whether it be Edwards Air Force Base, whether it be Los Alamos or White Sands, whatever. I think probably overall there's probably 1,000 to 2,000 people at the base at any one given time. The most would probably be up around 4,000. But as far as it's shutting down, I don't believe that's going to happen. And if it does, I'm going to be very upset because I've been lied to since 1955 about it being there in the first place.
It would be a waste of money. They put a lot of operations.
Well, they built another. We thought at first it was a taxiway, but it looks like it may even be a small runway between the two other runways. And this has been picked up on some satellite pictures recently. It's got fresh asphalt, and you can tell that it's new. So it could be a short runway for smaller aircraft that they're using now instead of the long runways. What takes place there is anybody's guess. We know that they do test the new aircraft. Secret aircraft are tested there on a regular basis. But they do a lot of radioactive stuff. And they burn radioactive waste on top of the ground. No place else in the United States is that permitted. The Environmental Protection Agency does not allow it. However, the President of the United States, since Clinton, every year puts out a proclamation exempting Area 51 from the law. So they're above the law. I wrote an editorial on that. It's on my website that you can read about them doing this toxic waste burning. There have been two guys that have died of radiation exposure. Their wives went to court. They tried to sue. They were told you can't sue something that doesn't exist. In 1985, they bought, they say they bought, the Air Force went to Congress and bought an additional 8,000 acres of land. The reason for it was national security. That encountered two mountains where people would be able to go up and look into the base. You can no longer do that. The closest you can get to the base and see anything is 23 miles away. So it takes some pretty good equipment to be able to get any pictures of the base from that far away.
Did you run across anybody like Rachel that works out at Area 51?
I didn't personally, but Chuck has. He's talked to several. In fact, there was four guys that have died of pretty rare cancer over the last few years, and nobody talks about it, he said. And with him living there, he respects the fact that they work there. So they don't, when they get together at the Alien Inn or wherever, they really don't talk about it because the guys can't talk about it, so he doesn't put them in a position where they would.
When we talk about radiation problems, this is out in the middle of nowhere. That's pretty tough to get treatment even.
Well, getting treatment?
Treatment for people like the people that are working at Liv and Rachel.
I would guess that they have pretty good facilities at the base itself for that. But one thing my wife noticed, and I didn't pay much attention to it, but while I was being awed by the guards and things like that, she was walking around, and she said she never saw any insects of any kind. No flies, no bugs, no nothing. And I kidded with her, and I said, well, that's because of the radiation. It's all been wiped out. But it really was a little odd when you think about it that she didn't see anything that would indicate there was any type of insects there. We saw one antelope driving into the main gate by itself, and that was the only living thing we saw.
When you were spotted, you stopped your car and turned around? Was that the
deal? Oh, no. When we pulled up to the, when we came around that corner and we saw the guards up on the hill with the binoculars on us, we just stopped, got out, got my camera, took a couple pictures of them, waved at them.
And, did they wave back?
No. No, they're very very unsociable. But we stood there and we talked and we looked around and saw the cameras and all the security equipment they have. Chuck Clark had found a sensing device some time ago, I believe 15 miles outside of the boundary. And Chuck being what he is and how he is, he found it with a metal detector. And he went over, he picked it up, turned it upside down, and looked at it and wrote down the numbers on it, took pictures of it and stuff like that. Not too long after that, Chuck went on vacation. While he was on vacation, the FBI went into his trailer and took all his computer equipment and all his disks and things like that. He wound up going back down to Las Vegas and talked to the head of the FBI down there, and they really were going to try to charge him with being a terrorist. And he said, my only question, he said, I know what the law is. He said, I haven't broken the law, but he said, I want to know why you have a sensor 15 miles outside the border. And they said, here's your equipment. We'll see you later. They never told him why the sensors were there.
How about other people in Rachel besides Chuck? They all are aware of that. That's probably the reason most of these people live there. For one reason or another.
Some of them have work on ranches that are in the areas. There's a couple of them employed there at the Little Alien Inn. When you have 85 people as your total population, you know, it doesn't take much to spread the wealth around, really. But there's some that are retired, and they're all aware that the base is over there, and from time to time they have people that will drop in that have worked at the base.
Now, I called Pat one night when I was doing live radio about 2 o'clock in the morning to see what was happening at the Little Alien Inn, and she told me that she had seen an entity inside the bar.
That's Pat. She was in the bar, and she saw something.
No one else talked about that.
No. The Little Alien Inn is a tourist attraction. There's no doubt about that.
She would say that because we were on about 160 sessions.
They have a wall with celebrities and different pictures of people. I'm going to get my picture put on the wall there.
Oh, well, good.
And they want to sell some of my tapes and stuff. But it's just a quaint little place to stop and visit. Good food and good fellowship when you go in there and see everybody.
Now when you were there, it was some sort of seminar?
Yeah, Ike Bishop sets up a Rachel UFO conference every year. And this is, I don't know, fifth, sixth, seventh year he's had it. And he contacted me last year and asked me if I would come out to be one of the speakers. And I knew I was going to lose money on the trip, as I do on most lectures I do. So my wife and I decided we'd just make a vacation out of it and went to Hoover Dam and Las Vegas and the Grand Canyon while we were on the same trip. And then we were in Rachel itself for 3 days, had a meet and greet on Friday night and dinner. And then I did a lecture on Saturday afternoon and a Sunday morning. I did two lectures while I was there.
Well, you know, the one thing, the reason I brought that up is that the place has what we call in the business sex appeal,
mm-hmm.
because of the reputation.
Sure.
But it's so difficult to get there, you wonder how big of a crowd they really do get.
I think it's a lot like Roswell. You know, Roswell's out here in the middle of nowhere.
But it's bigger than Rachel.
Oh, yeah, a lot. by a lot.
But in fact, you have quite a few things there now.
The curiosity, I guess, of Area 51, people will want to go there, and it definitely is out of the way. If you're gonna go to Rachel, you're going to want to go to Rachel, probably, because
there's nothing else there.
Nothing else there between Las Vegas and Nevada, Utah.
So you had a fairly good crowd. I imagine there were campers.
They had the lecture at the senior center, which could seat 60 people, and I think we probably had 55.
A full house.
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah.
In fact, you had a full house here in Roswell yesterday.
I did, yeah.
What did you talk about yesterday?
I did the Roswell incident yesterday for the celebration this year, and I did my complete story of the Roswell incident then and now.
Yeah, well, that is an interesting topic in itself. We talked to you a little bit about that one.
Yeah, I'm working two new cases right now, Jerry.
Well, you tell me a little bit about those if
you can. One involves a location just west of town, which I had never heard about before, and we're doing a lot of checking. I found the ranch last week. I did some research and found the location of the ranch, and now we're trying to locate some of the names of the people that were supposedly involved. And then I also am working a case where I got the name of a guy who claims to have been one of the pilots that flew some of the stuff out of here. And he's still alive, and I'm going to get in touch with him sometime this coming week.
So you haven't made contact yet?
Not yet. No, I just got the information.
But he is alive.
It's
getting pretty small, that club of people
surviving. We've lost three first-hand witnesses. Of course, Walter Hart passed away. He was the public relations officer out at the base that wrote the article, "We Captured the Flying Saucer." D. Proctor was the kid who went out to the debris site with ranch foreman Mac Brazel. He passed away. And then James Bond Johnson passed away. James Bond Johnson was the guy that took the pictures in General Ramey's office. And when that came out on the Internet, I was trying to verify that he had actually passed away, and I was having a hard time verifying it. And finally I decided, well, I'll just write to him, and if he doesn't answer, I'll assume it's right, you know. And fortunately for me, his son wrote back to me and thanked me for writing, and decided to use a interview that I did with James Bond Johnson a few years ago at the memorial service. He handed that out at the memorial service, which was quite an honor for me to have him do that.
You talked to him personally when he was alive. What was basically his story?
Johnson?
Yes.
He was the one that took the pictures in General Ramey's office when...
Was he stationed in Fort Worth, or was he here?
He worked for the... He was a newsman.
Oh, he worked for the newspaper, Fort Worth Star-Telegram.
Right.
Right, okay,
right.
I remember.
And, in fact, was the only person available that had a camera at the time, and went out to General Ramey's office and took six pictures in General Ramey's office of General Ramey. Colonel DeBose, the adjutant of the 8th Air Force, and Major Marcel. And there was no doubt that he actually took them pictures, but later in life he seemed to embellish his story a little bit, and I questioned him a lot about that, because the big thing with Ramey was the piece of paper he was holding in his hand facing the camera that we have started to try to analyze and see what's on it, and we're pretty much in agreement that the words "victims of the wreck" or on that piece of paper that General Ramey's holding, which means it wasn't a weather balloon. And I don't know why he embellished his story a little bit, but just before he passed away, he had written to me and asked me if I'd change that, and I told him, no, I won't change it because that's what you said. But if you want to do another interview, I'll be happy to do that, and we never did get around to that.
He wanted to change it in what way?
I think he wanted to correct or try to correct what he has told me before.
Did he tell you before that the thing was upside down? And
basically, yeah, that he was probably wrong and that he assumed too much in what he had told me before. There's no doubt about it. He took the pictures. I'll never question that. But this is true with a lot of witnesses for Roswell. They have a reason for embellishing their story a little bit, and that really makes it difficult for us researchers to do our work.
We'll be back. We'll talk more about Roswell in a moment. I'm going to get back to Rachel in Area 51 before it's over, and a couple of other issues that Dennis has been covering as well. One of our favorite people. That website is Truth Seekers or Seeker at Roswell?
TruthSeeker@Roswell.com.
Okay.
All one word.
We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippin.
Tales of the Strange and the Unknown. Every month in Fate Magazine. Fate Magazine has actually been published continuously since 1948. That makes it the longest-running publication of its kind. From psychics and spiritualists, archaeological hotspots and fringe science, to authoritative UFO and paranormal investigations, Fate articles are factual, informative, and entertaining. Subscribe to Fate Magazine today. Simply go to FateMag.com, FateMag.com, or check it out at your local newsstand. Fate Magazine is a favorite for people looking for answers and for people looking for entertainment.
Fate.
Tales of the Strange and the Unknown.
Dennis Balthizer, we're sitting here and we're talking about your trip to Area 51. We're here at Earth Station Roswell's Visitor Center. And you've been here 10 years in Roswell. You've seen quite a few changes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I was with the museum from 96 to 98 and then started doing my research as an independent. I still work with Stanton Friedman quite a bit and one or two other researchers and staying busy. I write editorials about every other month that are posted on 21 websites, including yours. UFO Magazine has picked them up and then do lectures whenever I can get anything booked.
When we were talking about the Carswell scene with the photographer who you interviewed before he passed away for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, mm-hmm. and you mentioned that he might have embellished something a little bit, you've investigated this for a long time now, and you were interested in Roswell before you moved here. This is the reason you moved here, I think.
Right.
What kind of conclusion or thought or feeling to this story at this time?
I think Roswell is still the granddaddy of UFO crashes. I think that it happened. Can I tell you what happened? No. But I can tell you that something happened in 1947 that is still covered up today. We've had four excuses from the United States Air Force. First one said we had captured a flying saucer and had it in our possession, the only time in the history of the United States that the media has made such a statement. The only time. The next day, General Ramey covered it up, said it was a weather balloon, and then the story died. And back in 1978, it opened up again when Stanton Friedman found Major Marcel in Louisiana, the intelligence officer. Research started again. In 1994, the Air Force came out with a 2.5-inch thick report saying that it wasn't a flying saucer, it wasn't a weather balloon, it was a Mogul balloon. Mogul balloon being a balloon, a high-altitude balloon that was used to track the Russians to see if they were doing any nuclear testing. Only problem with that story was that the Russians didn't do nuclear testing until 1949, 2 years after Roswell. So then in 1997, about 2 weeks before the 50th anniversary, the Air Force came out with their infamous book called The Roswell Incident Case Closed, where they said they had never mentioned the bodies before, and now they want to reveal that the bodies were anthropomorphic crash test dummies. The Air Force would have been better off not doing that because they shot themselves in the foot. The dummies weren't used till 1953, 6 years after the Roswell incident. So we've had four excuses in 58 years. I fully expect we'll probably have another one. If you're a wagering man, I'd put money on it. My personal feeling on the Roswell incident is that whatever we recovered, we still don't know what we have. Meaning that if they can get here from wherever they're from, they have technology and knowledge that we can't comprehend. And until we get full military benefit out of whatever we recovered, the public will not know about it and they will deny it. We don't use anything in our daily life that the military hasn't already used. Technology in the military advances about 20 years for every calendar year. So they're that far ahead of us all the time. And I think whatever we have, whatever we recovered, is still being analyzed. And until they get the military benefit out of it, it won't go public.
When we talk to people here in Roswell, and in fact people in official positions such as Air Force investigators, which you've had run-ins with, mm-hmm. or we assume they were, I've come to the conclusion over the years that perhaps these Air Force investigators don't know much more than we know.
I think that's right. I believe that that's a very true statement. And I think those that do know are very, very few. Most security that we have is in pyramidal shape, meaning that as you go up the pyramid on the sides, the more you get to the top, the less people that are involved, and the more they know. So down at the bottom of the pyramid, you have a guy over here who has a job and one over here, and neither one of them knows what the other one's doing. And I think that what you just said is very accurate, because I don't think they know what they have. We can't go there, but if they can come here, then we're way behind.
When you were in Rachel, right outside Area 51, and we talked about the population very small. Now, Pat's Indiana is busy all the time because it's a tourist recommendation, and people take that highway, especially since the governor made it the extraterrestrial highway,
right?
Even though it's really out in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
Did she tell you or anybody there that works there or anybody that lives there that these Air Force investigator types go into that bar?
Oh, yeah. They have them constantly, that there's groups coming in from Washington, from other places, and they'll come into the bar and the cafe and eat. Don't talk about anything usually, but they do come in, yeah.
So they're probably just like the rest of us. I want to see the place, too.
Yeah, and they have a job. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Just like the guards, I mean, they have a job, maybe an unforsaken job, being out there in the middle of nowhere, or maybe it's punishment. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to respect that. And like I said earlier, I don't want my adversaries knowing what we're doing. We don't need Iran or Korea or anybody else knowing what's going on. And that's the reason that they've gone underground with a lot of this stuff. And most countries have done this, not just the United States. With the satellites today, they can read a newspaper from 200 miles up, so you can imagine what they can see. So a lot of the secret work that we do has to be done inside hangars and buildings, or it has to be done underground.
Well, that gets back to, that takes huge amounts of construction, and you would think there'd be some road with a lot of truck construction there. I guess I just don't quite understand.
Well, there probably is, Jerry, but when the sign says the use of deadly force is authorized, you don't necessarily want to go any further than that. Yeah.
Anybody there? You didn't see any extraterrestrials or UFOs while you were there, right?
No, I'm married to one, but other than that.
That'd be okay.
No.
Do you hear any stories there about people that have seen, that obviously they see UFOs?
Yeah, Chuck Clark has documented lots of stuff that he has seen for extended periods of time. A lot of the stuff at Area 51 belongs to us, and there's no doubt about that. When you're testing secretive aircraft and things like that, can you imagine the first time people saw the B-1 or the B-2 bomber coming at them? It looks exactly like a flying saucer online. And the stealth, I mean, those are weird-looking airplanes. And for the public to see that for the first time, it would get your attention.
You know, we're doing several series centered around extraterrestrials and J-Rod and the legend of J-Rod. Area 51 is one of those. You're an expert on Area 51.
Oops, watch that word.
Okay, you're an authority.
Okay.
Well, you're educated on the subject of Area 51.
Right.
Any evidence that that might be true in your own mind of extraterrestrials being there?
Well, that's the rumor, of course, yeah. Yes, they're there. And even maybe some of the Roswell craft or the debris from the Roswell craft could be there.
Well, I was thinking more in terms of something live, stay in.
Well, that's been rumored over the years, but nothing's been substantiated to prove it. And that's the problem with ufology is that, you know, you hear rumors. But until you can verify and confirm something, I am not the type of inspector researcher that believes in sensationalism. And that's probably why I don't get invited to more lectures, to do more lectures. I don't buy sensationalism. I do honest, down-to-earth research and share that with the public, either through editorials, lectures, or like radio shows like this, where I can share my research and let the audience decide what they want to believe.
Somebody, and you're closer to Los Alamos, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody told me, really, that's where all the action is. What do you think?
Well, there's a lot of action there, yeah. we have, two of the national labs right here in New Mexico, and then we have White Sands just south of us. So we're a pretty hot state when it comes to security stuff. There have been rumors that perhaps one of the bodies from Roswell was taken to Los Alamos in 1947. The others probably taken up to Wright Field or Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, because they had cold storage facilities. They were doing research and development there. It would have been the logical place to take the debris.
Since you're in New Mexico, have you ever been to one of these crash retrieval sites? I know you go up to Aztec as well.
I've been to the Aztec site several times. I've been out here to the Roswell site many times. It's not easy to find. It's on BLM land. And I don't know if I ever shared the story about the environmental impact study done on the Roswell site years ago.
No, I'd like to know about that.
The BLM, Bureau of Land Management, Department of the Interior, does environmental impact studies on ranches now on a periodic basis. And I happened to hear about a study they did on the Foster Ranch up in near Corona where the crash happened. So I went out to the BLM and asked them if I could get a copy of it, and I got it, and started reading through it, and there was a note in there about being careful out there on this site because of aliens being present.
Oh, really?
And this was signed off by about seven people. Well, I got my attention. So I went back and I said, okay, where did you get this information? Who's responsible for it? They said, oh, well, that shouldn't have been in there. That was a joke. I said, well, joke or not, it's signed off by seven people here. And they said, well, that won't be in the final version. I said, I want a copy of the final version. So when the final version came out, I got a copy. Sure enough, it didn't say anything about aliens, but it did say that this is the alleged site of a 1947 crashed UFO. That was a big step for me. That was a United States agency, the BLM, the Department of the Interior, is saying in a official report that this story could be true. They're not saying it is. They're saying alleged. But that's a step forward in the right direction. They have restricted that particular land. They will build nothing on top of it, and you cannot direct drill on it. You can side drill it, but you can't drill directly down on it. So they are preserving it, and that was good to hear that somebody has finally taken some steps to preserve the location.
Now, the ranch itself, is it still in operation?
It's a working ranch, I believe owned out of Texas by someone now. There's a lot of land up here in New Mexico is leased. And the Sci-Fi Channel did a dig with the University of New Mexico Archaeological Group a couple years ago, and they have a permanent marker out there now. It looks like a tombstone. It's a granite stone that has an inscription on it. So the location is actually positively identified now.
So to make it a little easier, is there a major road that goes out there?
No. You'd have to know where you're going, and you'd want to be careful because it is some private land out there, and you have to go across pasture land, high desert, to get to the actual site. But unless you know where you're going or would have permission, I wouldn't suggest going out.
How about the Aztec crash scene? Basically the same type thing? Or
no, the Aztec one you can get right to up in Hart Canyon, east of Aztec. Aztec is really a strange deal. When I first heard about that years ago, I didn't put much confidence in it. But Scott Ramsey out of North Carolina.
Know Scott very well, he and his wife.
Good researcher. He has done some excellent work recently, and we're really starting to think like maybe something did happen in Aztec. And, well, there's controversy whether it was in 1948 or 1949. The craft supposedly was 99 feet in diameter and had 13 bodies on it. Recovered probably by a military base out of Colorado, and they have an annual symposium up there and bring in good serious researchers, and it's not a carnival type atmosphere or anything like that, and it's something we're really looking at because Scott's done such good work on uncovering some of the things that are involved in it.
Well, you have always been almost every year involved at Aztec, either as a speaker or the MC.
Right, right.
And
yeah, I've been honored. I've been actively involved for 9 years in every one they've done. And like you say, either as a master of ceremonies or a speaker. And I've got to meet a lot of neat people. Met Travis Walton a couple years ago from Fire in the Sky out in Arizona.
You're pretty impressed with Travis.
I was very impressed with Travis. Travis has been exposed to something that is very obvious. His demeanor, his actions are very, very obvious that he has experienced something earth-shattering to him. And it was a pleasure to meet him. I met Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, the sixth man on the moon, had a long private discussion with him. He told me that the Roswell incident did happen. Wouldn't tell me anything else. He also told me that we have two governments. We have a black government and an elected government. When I questioned him about that, he, I said, who do they answer to? He said, they don't. I said, they have to answer to somebody. He said, no. And, you know, we've talked about Majestic 12, MJ-12 with Roswell over the years. Those guys are all dead, but I would guess that there probably is still a group similar to that, maybe not under that name. And I would guess, and I'll probably get in trouble for this, but I would guess that George Bush Sr. and Henry Kissinger are probably part of that.
Well, that will be right back. I wanted Dennis to tell me that he had met an E.T., but he just straight shooter.
Can't lie to you.
but you have met investigators who were investigating investigators.
Yeah.
Which happens, and we have that on our website. They need to hear that story about your encounter with, I guess, Air Force.
OSI?
Yes, I assume that's who they were.
Yeah, that's what they said they were.
Well, that doesn't necessarily prove it. We'll be back in a moment. This is Jerry Pippin.
The doors are finally open at shopjerrypippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition T-shirt selections features 3 different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector T-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at shopjerrypippin.com.
Dennis Malthizer, Area 51 and Roswell, that's in your expertise. I never really understood, I guess, other than your engineering background with this Texas Highway Department. Some of those freeways are pretty colossal, but they're not like the pyramids. But you're very, very interested in the pyramids, aren't you?
Nothing is like the pyramids. Yeah, I have been interested in them for several years, many years. I've been a history buff all my life and interested in things that other people could care less about. I'm the type of person, I may have been brought up in a box, but somehow I managed to get out of the box. I don't believe in living in a box because there's too much interesting information out there.
Well, this guy's a country music drummer at one time. And
was.
He's had all kinds of experiences. So go ahead, let's talk about these pyramids and why you're interested.
Well, I got put on the advisory board of the Great Pyramids of Giza thanks to Jeff Rentz on the sightings on the radio. John DeSalvo is the head of the group out of Minnesota, and they have about 30 different people from all over the world, pretty reputable people, such as Egyptologists, physicists. They're just high-class people that super intelligence, and then me. And but they
kind of like the crowd I don't run around.
they've had an interest in the possibility, and that's what I want to use that word, possibility, that there may have been some ET involvement in the building of the pyramids. And Jeff suggested they put me on the board, and I happily accepted that. And we are of the opinion that the pyramids of Giza, and I'm only talking about the three pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx, are not Egyptian. That's going to be a hard sell because of tourism in Egypt being big business. But we have reason to believe that those three pyramids and the Sphinx were built prior to the Egyptian civilization. And what we base that on primarily is the deterioration on the Sphinx, which was caused by water. There hasn't been that amount of water in that part of the world for 15,000 years, and that automatically predates the Egyptian civilization. The other thing is that we have located a civilization known as Khemitians, K-H-E-M-I-T-I-A-N. And the Khemitian civilization lived in North Africa prior to the Egyptians, predominantly controlled by women, by the female gender, and supposedly had contact with star people. If that's the case, then I'm not saying that ETs built the pyramids, but I am saying that they may have had involvement in providing technology to build the pyramids. The Great Pyramid of Giza, supposedly, according to Egyptologists, was built for Khufu of the 4th Dynasty. When the Arabs first went in that pyramid in 890 AD, they found nothing inside, only an empty coffer, a box with no lid. If it had been the burial chamber for Khufu, there would have been all his lively possessions. There would have been hieroglyphics. There would have been all kinds of things for him to take to the afterlife, which they believed in. Nothing was found in there. Joe Parr, one of the researchers on our board, has spent two nights on top of the pyramid on two different occasions with equipment. He is convinced that the Great Pyramid of Giza is an energy source and that it was built as an energy device of some kind. Originally, the three pyramids were covered with a polished limestone covering that was probably visible from the moon with the sun reflection. That was all removed and used for the Arabs building mosques and things like that over the years. Napoleon Bonaparte went inside there with his troops and all the people he had with him when he invaded Egypt and spent the night in there and came out and would never talk about it again. They think he probably foresee his future while he was in there. One of the researchers, Vladimir Krasnolovits. I love it when I can say that.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
He's a Russian from Ukraine. The Ukrainians have built some pyramids and done some research, and they have found that bacteria doesn't grow, water doesn't freeze at 40 below zero. Crops like wheat and barley, the seeds produce 30 to 50% more production inside the pyramid. So something happens inside a pyramid that we're still not aware of. We're of the opinion that they were probably built using vibration or water to levitate the stones. These stones weigh anywhere from 2 to 70 tons each. The Great Pyramid is over 400 feet high. If you believe the story that they used slaves or workers over a 20 or 30 year period, if you start and do the calculation on that, they would have had to put a stone on the pyramid every 90 seconds. That's impossible. So I don't know if we'll, in my lifetime, know the answer to how they were built or not. They're the only wonder of the original seven wonders of the world still standing. My engineering background kicks in here because someone that built them has some tremendous knowledge about substructures, because with the weight of those pyramids, by this length of time, they should have started to sink into the dirt, into the sand.
They don't.
And they haven't. The accuracy on the pyramid is a quarter inch on each side. The last job I did with the Highway Department, the Houston Ship Channel, we had a 1,200-foot span. We got to the middle. We were off by 3 feet. That's pretty good. We're off a quarter inch on a side with the pyramid. Some of the stones are cut to within a 50th of an inch to fit up to each other. The engineering is just absolutely mind-boggling. So we're looking at all kinds of things on this. There is one guy over there that has a lot of the history in his head. He's passed that on to his daughter, and one of our researchers is working with him. He's an Egyptian. Nothing's written down. He has this all in his head, and he's passing it down to the daughter. He doesn't want to write anything down. But he is sharing a lot of information with us about his knowledge of the Kemetian civilization through his ancestry and things like that.
We haven't talked about subterranean...
underground?
I guess that's what we call them, bases.
They don't exist.
You don't think so?
I'm here to tell you they do. The underground bases is another reason, I guess, my civil engineering background, that kicked in. I always wondered, you know, I've heard these stories about all these tunnels and underground stuff and wondered how are they built and what kind of equipment are they using and things like that. And doing the research on it, I come to find out that the United States government, the Pentagon, has at least one machine that we know about. I found a drawing of a patented nuclear machine that was developed at Los Alamos in 1973 that can go through the ground, create a hole, and as it's going through, it melts the rock and dirt into a magma and pushes it into the wall, makes a glass-like lining as it goes through the earth. Nothing comes above the ground. Nothing has to go below the ground. They could go under us right now, and we wouldn't know they were there.
Did they use that to build Cheyenne Mountain, I wonder?
They didn't use that particular one, no. And I don't know whether that one's ever been used, but I do have a drawing of it and the patent number out of Los Alamos in 73. So that's been 30 years ago. Maybe who knows what they have today. But the tunnel between France and England was built using six of them. And some of these machines can bore a hole up to 30, 35 feet in diameter, probably push through at 5 foot an hour or so. And they've been used for some time for different things, creating tunnels for railroads, for water movement and things like that. So the government's not going to miss out on the boat and use them also. They have vertical ones that can go down that they've used to build the missile silos. And a lot of times these things are so big that they have to assemble them underground. They could be up to 300 feet long. And they're just fabulous pieces of machinery.
And nothing new this year on finding anything out of Dulce or anything like that?
No, Dulce still bothers me because I'm beginning to think Dulce's a diversionary site, maybe that Navajo Dam is up there nearby, and I think that it would probably be the source for electrical power for Dulce. We've heard all kinds of rumors about 4 to 7 levels below ground, biogenetics taking place there and things like that, but nothing that's verifiable. But Dulce could easily be a diversionary site to cover something that's somewhere else that where they are doing that.
Well, that's one of the standard operating procedures, using a little diversion here and there and there.
Oh, they wouldn't do that, would they?
Our time's almost up here, Dennis. Is anything...
No, I just appreciate what you do, Jerry. You have one of the best shows on radio, and I appreciate you giving us researchers the opportunity.
He reads as well.
You give us the opportunity to share our research with the public, and I think that's something that's needed because the media is doing a lousy job of it. And I'm talking about national media that has the opportunity to help us and doesn't do it. So I appreciate what you and some of the other guys do on your radio shows, and we thank you for that.
So, basically, you didn't talk to the guard at Area 51.
Nope.
And you didn't see the underground bases there, or not even one barrack. Huh?
Not one.
Not one little...
Well, we did see something that...
A mess hall or nothing?
No, but coming away from the gate where the signs say they'll shoot you, we did see something that was kind of strange out on the side of the road. It was a steel drum with a heavy steel lid on it. And I told my wife, I said, there it is. That's an air chamber of some kind. So we walked over and looked at it and you know, studied it a little bit and went back into Rachel and found out that it was nothing but a well cap.
Darn, I thought I had an exclusive.
Right.
Dennis Balthizer, it's been a joy. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Basically, this year, 2007, Roswell will be having a week-long celebration. The official UFO celebrations are slated to start on July 5th and run through Sunday, but actually there will be other events in the week. And on the 4th of July, there will be a big fireworks celebration. lots of music and fun, even a Christian concert, and a dinner for all of the veterans, and lots of other things on the agenda. Keep on checking our Roswell pages for more information, and I think you'll enjoy the trip to Roswell, but we urge you to make your reservations now. Accommodations will be limited. They expect over 500,000 people in Roswell during the week. Today's show was edited by Jane Swartley. Our on-location executive producer was Roberta Scott, and our studio engineer was James Smith. From Roswell, this is Jerry Pippin. Thank you for listening. And oh yes, cheers.